Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
This photograph comes from the year 2012, just after the solar eclipse that that we drove out to see in Northern California. It was one of those annular solar eclipses. I should show some photos from that sometime soon, too, of how cool that eclipse was. And so on the drive back from that eclipse, we did this big camping trip with about seven or eight people, and we made the stop on State Line Road on the border between California and Oregon near a wildlife wetland area where a lot of geese go to migrate to. I think this was in May, but while the clouds were passing, we had this light breakthrough, and I had Dave walk along the road. And I was trying to play with backlight a little bit, like you can see the sun breaking through right behind his knee. And we had him throw his arm out extra wide to the back with his thumb out to get the right perspective for his thumb to kind of show that idea of being a hitchhiker on the road. But it was just kind of a fun concept photo, and I always liked how this one worked out with some of the backlighting and some of the lighting in the shadows and in the light in the sky up above.
You can see more of my work at billynewmanphoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there. Really trying to do a lot of scouting stuff, which I've enjoyed too. Doing some scouting stuff through the summertime has been pretty cool, where I'm really trying to go through some of these back roads. I'm trying to like mark spots on the map where there's good campsites, which I hadn't really done before. You know, there's a lot of places I've driven, a lot of roads I've been on, and especially, you know, like backcountry roads too, Forest Service roads, BLM roads. And I know a lot of good dispersed camping areas. And really, I understand the context of how to find those areas so much better now that I'm older than when I was young. I mean, when I was young and I'd go camping with my dad, you know, we'd go out to Eastern Oregon, we'd find some spots, and they had known about those spots since, you know, he was a kid and he was going over there and hunting camps and stuff with his grandpa. So it's cool for me to get to go over to those same spots and get to check out that area and stuff. But I think there's been, or at least when I was a kid, I didn't really understand the land, like the public land rights that you have, and really how those are organized, like how public lands are organized and what you can do on them, and sort of how it operates. I didn't really understand the difference between national forest land and BLM land, or national park land and state park land, or wilderness areas, national wildlife refuge areas. Man, there's just so many different distinctions of different things. And then also just private property. So I didn't really have a clear recollection of any of those things. And really a lot of time when it's public land, you can go on it, but there's some things you can't do on it. Like either maybe hunt in some circumstances, like a national park, or I think you can't discharge a firearm inside a national park, but for specifically permitted events, maybe probably national wildlife refuges. I think those hunting opportunities are limited also, though you can still do some things in those areas. I think you have to get permitted and you have to draw a tag for that location, I think is what it is. But yeah, it's kind of interesting sort of learning about that, learning how these things go, and also finally getting some maps that you can use that you can kind of trust better while you're in the backcountry. I think that's something that's really helped me kind of understand where I can go and what I can do. And I've had those map books, you know, like that 50 page or 100 page book of Oregon. And, you know, every page is a 25 mile map of that area. It was always super useful how they kind of grid out everything and show you the mile by mile marking and the topography of the area, the different little roads and stuff. But even those roads, those map makers still got things wrong. I remember too, you know, back in like, was it 2004? I think we were out in an area in Southern Oregon near the Nevada border. Was it Drew's Reservoir? Somewhere south of Gearhart Mountain. And I remember we were on some little road. I don't even know if it was a national forest area. I think it was just is in between private and public lands as it kind of jumps back and forth in those pretty remote areas. All of it is just remote desert and forest and sagebrush and juniper. But some of it goes into like ranch land that's more managed, and some of it cuts back into BLM land as those little roads sort of meander through it. But I remember being out there and noticing that the map on the page was just totally different than the map, or than, you know, the real world ground truth of where the road went. And I thought, oh, whoa, yeah, you can't really trust the maps to show you the information that you want to see when you need it. Other times, too, you know, you'll see like, it shows there's a road right here. Good deal. We'll take that road. Well, you know, it shows it. It's on the map. So you cut down there, you get on the road, and then it's washed out like crazy, or it's super bumpy and like and just a terrible ride. But it's the same green roads, the same label, the same marking as the road next to it that was graded it's not paved, right? It's graded gravel. They put more gravel down, I think is what I'm trying to say. They've made it an easier going road to drive on. But then you get those washboard sections out there. I don't know if you guys have been on that, where you're driving around in the Forest Service roads and those gravel roads. And I think it's a natural process of erosion that occurs that creates these waves in the material. You know, as the rainwater comes down, it sort of naturally over time generates these little ripples. And that's the washboard effect that you get when you're driving. That's also the thing that kind of kicks your car sideways when you're going a little too fast on a gravel road. That's what I started doing today. I think I kicked it pretty hard side, or you know, like it was pretty loose on the traction, and it was starting to tip sideways in my truck. And so I slowed down and threw it into four-wheel drive after that, and was able to cruise around out here pretty freely. Yeah, I wanted to talk on this podcast about hanging out in the Fremont National Forest, and I just got finished with a huge thunderstorm that came through. It just really finished raining a little bit ago. I think when I arrived here today at this meadow, it was still a few hours before sunset, so I walked around and kind of went along the perimeter of the meadow, and then I noticed that, you know, I mean, it's cloudy. It's been kind of cloudy today, and there's been thunderheads that have been building up over the location that I've been. Ever since I kind of came over the pass of the Cascades, I've been in like a pretty solid string of thunderheads that have sort of coalesced into a big mass over the Cascades. Some of it here over the Fremont National Forest, whatever mountains these are that I'm in. And yeah, it seems like this section of Eastern Oregon was getting hit with a good summer August thunderstorm today, which was kind of fun to sit through and go through. It was cool. I got rained on pretty hard earlier when I was driving over, and I thought I'd get out here and be a little bit more free of it, but it seemed like that storm kind of drifted over this way and then was sort of drifting north from here. And yeah, it was a new system, but man, there was just a bunch of lightning that was coming through and huge cracks of thunder, just big, deep rumbles. I haven't heard thunder like that in years and years, probably, you know, where it just kind of stays and like hangs and rolls for 10 seconds, 15 seconds, it seems like, you know, where you just really kind of like, whoa, can it really still be just cracking and rumbling and rolling? And there was enough lightning activity that was going on there where you'd hear thunder. I mean, it was almost like 45 minutes there where there was just a crack and a roll of thunder almost continuously. Like it was pretty intense. It's really, I think, one of the more strong lightning storms I've been in a while, but that's sort of how it goes out here when you're at these higher elevations. I think I'm floating around up in the 5,100 feet or so above sea level, and so it just means I'm up in the mountains where these thunderstorms get started. You know, they get their, I think that's where they all kind of coalesce over these big mountaintops and then float over in the hot weather. I don't really understand the weather enough to say I know how a thunderstorm starts or doesn't start. Now, I've just gotten cold enough. I'm trying to throw a jacket on. I know. You got to live through it. I'm really camping. It's been good. But I'm going to be out here for two nights, I think, is what I'm going to do. And then tomorrow I'll cruise out and I'll try and hit some of these Forest Service roads for a bit. Drive around, do some exploring, mark a couple spots on the map as I'm cruising around. I think that'll be a good time. But yeah, I haven't been out here before. I think I've heard of a couple friends that have been out in this area that have done some, I think they did a couple scouting trips for a hunting trip that they were going on in the fall. I think this is an area where one of my friends goes. I think they try and draw a tag for, not this area. I think it's a drainage over from here. But I think I've heard about this area a couple times from people talking about it. So yeah, it's cool. It's a cool spot. I was out taking pictures earlier, taking some photographs. I've been working mostly, probably for almost a year and a half now. I've been working a lot with this 17 to 40 millimeter wide angle Canon lens. And it's a pretty inexpensive lens. I think you can get it for like $400, maybe a little less if you're lucky and you get it on a sale time. Sometimes in the fall, as we're kind of ramping down toward toward Thanksgiving, I think you can get some good deals on it. But that's, yeah, it's sort of in the $400 range. I think sometimes maybe it's more around $500 or something. But I picked it up a couple years ago when I was starting to do real estate photography. Well, I was working for Airbnb for a while, where they had hired me as a photographer to go into these Airbnb Plus listings and get a new set of photographs. That was interesting, kind of learning about how specific they wanted all of those photographs and this really specific art style and you know, format of it. And that was fine. It was interesting to do for a while. But what was cool is I picked up that lens to get in and do that work. But really after that, I've been appreciating how much I can do with that wide angle lens. And then, you know, 40 millimeters isn't way different than 50 millimeters. It's certainly different for the effects of portraits and stuff. But when I'm out here doing landscape stuff and I'm trying to take pictures of a lot of this stuff is kind of sketch photos too, where I'm sort of going around at midday. I'm taking some photos of some different things. I want some camp photos of my truck and my little cooler set up in the back here. So all that's been good. In addition to that, the astrophotography stuff that I can do with it is pretty cool because it drops down to the 17 millimeters. It's an autofocus lens. It's a sealed lens. It's pretty good in most ways. And I've really noticed over time that I'm not as absolute of a mandate for me to be shooting at a really wide open f-stop. You know, if I'm shooting at a wide open aperture, almost all my photos early on were at 1.8 or 2.0 or 2.8 or something. And I would do that really because I was really trying to get, because I didn't have very many lenses, I was really trying to get as much effect out of that bokeh, out of that soft background as I could. So I was really trying to lean into that and get some photos with it. And I noticed with my camera and equipment at the time that it just looked better. It just did look better when it was at, you know, f1.8. I think I just had that nifty 50 Nikon 50 millimeter for the longest time. That's what I did my early trips on, and did a lot of my portfolio building stuff on that. But I've got a different 50 millimeter lens with me now. I've got it on my film camera in my bag right now, which I need to take out too. And I'm trying to finish a roll of Ektar film. It's been on there for a while. And I've enjoyed shooting it. It's cool. It's a new Canon camera to me, at least. I got it used on KEH and spent, I don't know, $35 on it, $10 to ship it. And it takes a weird battery, too. It's one of those 90s film cameras, and it has this weird, it almost looks like a battery pack. It's almost like two double A's, if they were a little fatter, that are bonded together in this little plastic pack, and then you pop that in there and shoot for a little while, I guess, and it runs a meter okay. So I'm getting by with it, but I've noticed with the film camera stuff, it's fun to have an awesome film camera. It'd be cool to have a Leica and all the lenses I wanted, but a lot of the time with that, you know, I have the good lenses. I have this newer like Canon L glass that I get to shoot through, and for film photos and for the variety of image or the variety of lenses I have, you know, I can do telephoto, I can do prime, I can do really wide angle, all with the modern digital Canon lenses that have, you know, chips in them that read well, that meter well, that make contact with the, or that send information back and forth, or at least from the lens to the camera, I think. Is that how it works? That works in the autofocus stuff for the digital camera. This is autofocus. So yeah, it's an autofocus digital camera. It's sending information back. It's working. Yeah. That makes sense, yeah. So it's cool. Like that's something I didn't really have available to me for a long time. You know, I think when I've probably on this podcast, if you go way back in the archives, I'm talking a lot about film with a Nikon F4. You know, I mean, that just had autofocus. That was the first camera, like 88, to get autofocus, period. So it's cool to have that in a more flexible way now. But what I remember talking about in the past a lot was that I had like limited options with glass a lot of the time. I didn't really always have the lenses that I would have preferred. And so I've kind of made a collection of that now with this Canon stuff. I've got a Canon camera, and so I can throw all those lenses on and have that same flexibility that I have with my digital set, but just with this film body that I get to shoot a roll through. So I kind of save the film stuff for when it's a thing that I want. But what I've noticed, though, for a little while is that I miss a lot of those moments, and I end up just having the norm, you know, the regular digital camera with me with a bunch of my other gear. When I've been going out, I've been trying to kind of just take the camera with me, and then I'll leave the bigger bag back at the truck so that I'm not really carrying as much stuff with me. I've also started carrying, like when I'm out here in the woods and stuff, I'm carrying a binocular harness with me, which is kind of cool. You can get them in different sizes, but it's sort of like, if you imagine like a backpack, but what they do is they strap onto the front, so it's right on your chest. And what you can do is put like a pair of binoculars in there so you can pull them out and then scout around with your binoculars, do some glassing, and then pop them back into your harness, and then kind of carry on with whatever you want to do. But if you leave that empty without the binoculars, if you have a smaller camera rig, probably like a mirrorless or a Sony camera, you know, like one of those Sony A6000s, man, if you were a backpacker and you had a Sony A6000 and this this front carry like binocular pack, you'd be really set. That would be like all the camera bag that you'd need. In fact, really, if I'm thinking about ever doing some some longer backpacking travel where I just have to pack everything in and weight's going to be something I'm more conscious of, then I think that's really like the way to go. As I've kind of been thinking about it a little bit, is like get a lighter camera. Or, I mean, it'd be great to, like, carry, like, a 360 camera, you know, if you're going up somewhere. Those are almost nothing as it is anyway. But if you're carrying, like, an SLR or something that you want to try and do some more controlled photography with, and you had something like an A6000 from Sony or an A7R3 or whatever it is, something that size with a lens attached to it, you know, that could fit in one of these binocular harnesses and carry kind of right on your front. And then, oh, you see something, you want to take it, pop that open right on your chest, pull it right up to your eye. It's got straps on it in the harness. Pull it right up to your eye. It's ready to shoot. And you can take photos of it, or take photos, you know, as quick as you want to. So it's kind of a cool process if you're out hiking a lot. For what I'm doing, I have my binocular harness, but it's got binoculars in it. And I've been kind of going around. I've been trying to do some bird watching stuff while I'm out here. And I saw a cool hawk that was posted up who was looking at me. That's about all I've seen so far. I saw a coyote the other day. That was cool. I'll talk about that later, though. But so I have those binoculars in there, and I've been kind of going out on these shorter hikes and stuff. But I've been trying to go around and like just kind of watch some stuff or watch the land and kind of keep an eye out. But I just have the camera on my longer strap on my side with that 17 to 40 millimeter lens, and that's worked really good. And it's been a pretty flexible kit for me to go around and take a bunch of photographs with. So it's pretty easy, pretty lightweight to work with, and I can kind of move back and forth between those things strapped around my neck. You know, it's not everything just hanging around my neck with a lanyard. It's all kind of put somewhere or packed in somewhere. So that's been kind of cool. But it was good going out, taking some photos tonight. I was trying to get some of the I didn't get any lightning in the camera, though. The lightning storm kind of passed as soon as it was getting really dark enough to do like a long exposure kind of thing where I could sort of catch something sparking. Otherwise, you know, you gotta beat the lightning bolt with your shutter finger, and that's a pretty tricky task to do. I think that's how they do it. You know, when you get those like magazine photos back in the day of a powerful lightning bolt striking, I don't know, in the center of a road or something like that. That's what they'd show you, you know, some kind of power or lightning bolt. But the way that they would do that stuff is I think it was like it was dark out, you know, or pretty dark out. And so they'd set the camera up for just a cycle of long exposures, and then they would just kind of let it ride, you know. So they'd have a couple seconds to expose the image to whatever, you know, would work. And then they would just kind of have that rolling so that when a bolt of lightning did strike, and it would be captured, and you could go through that collection of captured, or, you know, how do I say that? When a lightning bolt would strike the ground, the camera would have already been exposing for a photograph because it's just cycling the shutter on a 4-second exposure, let's say something like that. And so, you know, it takes a 4-second exposure, stops, processes for a second, takes a 4-second exposure, stops, processes for a second. So I think that's how they did some of that stuff, where they kind of anticipate, all right, it's been a couple of minutes, let's take a frame now, and then it's just going to be an event in the future, so we don't know if it's going to happen or not. We're going to wait for this event in the future when we, boom, see a lightning bolt, and then that light then exposes the sensor or the film and the camera. And then you're left with an image that has that lightning bolt represented in the frame when you're shooting on a tripod or something like that with a short cycle, long exposure. And I thought that was pretty cool, but I didn't really get a chance to get all that stuff set up before the storm kind of passed me by. I did get a lot of cool handheld stuff that was that's great, of the Thunderheads and stuff. And really, unfortunately, just in the location that I'm at, a lot of the, and I guess maybe for the better, but that lightning storm didn't pass right over my head. It was still a little ways away, so I could see the lightning bolts cracking through the trees kind of out in the distance more. A few that stretched across the sky pretty good too. It was just, you know, a big old, you know, from east to west, it was like, you know, a big old chunk of a bolt that just crack all the way across the sky. It was cool. So I got some photos of the Thunderheads, the sunset, the big field out here. It's cool. It's a nice area. But I was also thinking about some of the other stuff that I want to be doing tomorrow. So I'm out in the Fremont National Forest. I'm going to be heading, I think, maybe south from here, and I'm going to try and explore a couple areas that are still open. I guess it's all open public land. This is like a pretty large contiguous section of national forest land here, and really, like, that's a big part of Oregon overall, right? It's like 53% public lands. It's cool, yeah. If you look at a map, you'll see the cities and you'll see like the highways and stuff. But if you have the right map, it'll show you where the BLM land is and where the different national forests are. And it's cool. This whole area of the Northwest is just, there's a lot of public land that you get to use, and there's a lot of open area that you get to go to. And yeah, now that I've got a good map of the outdoor off-road roads and some of the terrain and stuff with some good notes, and I'm able to kind of move around and get out to a lot more places than I had before. So it's been cool. The app that I'm using is the OnX Off-Road app. It's, I think, $29.99 a year. And so I pitched that out, picked up this app, and then you can download offline these really detailed off-road maps that are supposed to show you all the trails, you know, even just walking trails, all the roads, all of the like the pieces of information you'd need for kind of moving around in the backcountry. And really, as surprising as it is, as remote as a lot of these places are, people go here. You know, it's also public land that's managed by the Forest Service. Yeah, I think a lot of the stuff's managed by the Forest Service. The BLM stuff's managed by the BLM, but that's why these roads are as good as they are, or maintained, or that's why, like, when trees are downed on these mountain roads, you know, someone has to go through at the beginning of the year and cut all those out, rip them out, fill in the potholes, all that sort of stuff. So all these areas are known about and, you know, kind of managed in a pretty significant way. In fact, I think more so to come in the future. I think they just have announced yesterday or the day before that they've passed the Great American Outdoors Act, which I really don't know the first thing about, or what it does or doesn't do, or what it puts in or leaves out. But I think part of my understanding is that it's supposed to change some of the funding mechanisms that go into supporting the maintenance of these public lands that are out here across the country, but really significantly out here in the western states. So it's pretty cool. I think before that, it was like, well, we should spend you know, X amount of money, but there's a more important place for that money to go. So it wasn't like a guaranteed amount. It's sort of what I understand. So if I understand it correctly, there's like, I think they've said $3 billion a year of mandated funding for projects, I think, here in the backcountry, BLM land, Forest Service land, and like national wildlife refuges and stuff. So pretty cool. But yeah, I think that's going to, well, maybe we'll see a change in that. I think it's supposed to better fund the operations of BLM and Forest Service people as they're going through and trying to get these areas ready for the public to be using more regularly. So it's cool. I think it'll mean a lot over the next few years, or maybe we'll see how it kind of transforms some of the way that these areas are managed. I think maybe it's more for, well, you know, I probably shouldn't even speculate. I'm not sure at all. But it's pretty cool. I'm excited about being out here and doing some camping and stuff, dealing with this thunderstorm. I think it's one of those things where by the morning, you know, it's going to be, I was looking at the weather. It should be mostly cloudy, or partly cloudy, mostly sunny tomorrow for a while. So I think that's pretty cool. I'm excited to be hanging out, doing some camping stuff, doing some podcasting. I'm in the back of my truck right now. Like I was saying, it was raining earlier after those thunderstorms, so I got that canopy on my truck, and I'm nice and dry, nice and warm. It kind of feels like I'm just inside somewhere. So it's a cool rig, having the four-wheel drive, having the canopy on the back, having your stuff and your sleeping area just kind of set up back there, and I'm ready to go. So I've been having a good time being out here, and I don't know, it's been pretty good trip so far. So I appreciate you guys checking out this podcast from me. I'm going to do a couple more podcasts while I'm out here on this camping trip, and I'll try and set up a little backlog of them on my website. I think that'll be a good idea. I know I kind of take big breaks and stuff from it. I'm sure no one keeps listening when it is there. But hey, if you listen to this end of the podcast, shoot me an email. Time for the plugs. It's BillyNewmanPhoto.com. If you want to check out my website, see some of my photographs, check out more podcasts that I've done, or books that I've tried to put together, which is maybe what I'm going to try and do out here too. I'm going to try and get some photographs for another good book. You can check out more information at BillyNewmanPhoto.com. You can go to BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it. If you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon, that's Patreon.com/BillyNewmanPhoto. I bought a domain name, nightskypodcast.com, and so I'm trying to build a pretty simple WordPress site that can host a lot of the information about that podcast and about that project as a whole. So it'll be pretty basic, and it's not supposed to be something that's hugely complicated by any means, but I'm interested in, you know, just trying to make some different graphics and make some explanation of the podcast and sort of how it works, just to kind of differentiate it a little bit. And so it's just like a side project and a hobby. I'm trying to put it together, but I've been trying to find out some ways to do that in an easier way. So I've already built about 3 or 4 pretty usable WordPress websites. And what I was hoping to do is trying to take a lot of that work that I had already done and then migrate that over to this new Night Sky Podcast website that I'm trying to put together, along with another site that I'm trying to put together. I'll probably talk about that in the next podcast. But for this Night Sky Podcast website, what I was hoping to do was take like a lot of the way that I've customized the theme that I'm using and a lot of like the page layout stuff that I've already put together for, let's say, my Billy Newman Photo website. And I want to try and find a way to migrate that over to this Night Sky site and then strip out the parts that won't be the same. You know, I'll replace the graphics, replace a lot of the layout stuff in a way that would be unique and bespoke to the way that I want this Night Sky podcast website to go, but it's a little better than, or it's a lot less work. It's saving me a ton of time so that I don't have to go back through and make customizations to each of the fields associated with the site in a way that would be like brand new to it. So I'm trying to learn about that a little bit. What I've been trying to do is find out, I guess, different ways to do that. So one thing that I ran into while I was trying to do a bunch of this troubleshooting on my site over the last couple of weeks was that I'm really in need of making backups of my WordPress sites. And so what I went through and did is I made, and I'm sure there's ways within WordPress to do this, but I was using a plugin and you should let me know if anybody's listening out there and they've had experience doing backups of their WordPress site. You should let me know what was the most effective. There's like the cPanel backup that I've made from the server side, where I backed up the files that were associated with the website. And so hopefully that could be restored in a way that would be useful. But there's also some complications that I think I've run into with that. And it wasn't really as user-friendly as I wanted it to be. And the restore points, I don't know, it didn't really feel like it worked for me as well as I had hoped it would. It was very useful for me to do that when I did run into problems and I wasn't able to access the site. So I'm glad I had those backups of the cPanel. But if I do still have access to the WordPress dashboard of my website, what I'm hoping to do is use this plugin system that I found. And I'm sure like a million other people, according to what it said, have found it also. But I'm using this plugin called Updraft Plus to try and make
to try and make backups of my WordPress pages. So I went through and I made backups of each of the WordPress websites that I've created so far. And first, that was the BillyNewmanPhoto.com website. And then in addition to that, there was GoldenHourWedding.com. So I made backups of the both of those. And then there's another two websites that I'm still kind of working on, and I want to try and make those new. But I did make backups of those also, and I was able to save those on my server, but I was also able to download those to my local drive and put those on an external hard drive. And the great thing is that I can version those backups. So when I make adjustments or when I make updates to my site and I want to make another backup of it, I can make a backup and then I can download that. And that'll be like this was in January 2019, but with all these extra pieces of content and with all these extra additions to the site, this will be the backup I make in February 2019, something like that. What I'm trying to figure out, though, is, and I think what I've discovered is that what I want to do is take a backup of my WordPress site, let's say in this case, the BillyNewmanPhoto.com backup, and I want to use that to clone and then migrate that over to the NightSkyPodcast.com website. And so I think I found a way to do that even within Updraft Plus. Now, the Updraft Plus plugin offers a premium service where you can purchase the ability to do a database migration for, I think, $30. It's not $30 per site, but I think it's $30 for the plugin, and then you get support from that plugin developer for some period of time. I think it's like 6 months on the low end, and then if you need support for a longer amount of time, I think it's more money than that. There's probably some caveats to it, but that is an option that I'm trying to explore right now, is if I'd want to go through that process of using the Updraft Plus plugin to do a migration of my site where I can bring in a lot of the theme customizations, the theme itself, and the database with the updated database over to the Night Sky Podcast website. And it could be an easy sort of one-click solution for it, but I'm also trying to look around and see if there's other ways for me to do an import or a clone of the website and the website data so that I can bring in a lot of the information, but maybe leave out a lot of pieces that I won't need. Because I'm not really trying to make an exact duplicate or an exact copy. I'm just trying to bring over certain elements that have already been adjusted in a way that I don't really want to have to do the work over for. So if I could just kind of bring in this draft of a website version that's almost everything complete in the way that I want, and then delete the content that was on the blog, delete the pieces that were, you know, over in this section of the site, rewrite an about page and a couple paragraphs over here, recreate some graphics, then I would have like what would seem like a familiar site that would be on brand, but it would also be a new site that would have a lot of new content on it, and it would just kind of remain the way that I wanted it to. So that's sort of the hope that I'm trying to go for. And I guess that the Updraft Plus plugin creates like XML files for you to use, and I don't know how it really works, but I think if you break open the file that you've downloaded, you can go through and then there's an alternate way of making an upload for that sort of stuff. But I guess the problem is like the database. So if you're migrating a site, it's really expecting all those domain names to be what they had been in the past and not migrated or not a set of new links that have this new domain name. So everything's going to link back to another site that it's not at. So the database of it's just not going to make sense. And I think that's what this migration tool is supposed to help you do. So I'm looking into that, and I'm hopeful that that I can kind of put that together pretty quickly. I'm also trying to be conscious of my time a little bit too, so that I don't spend like a huge amount of time in development trying to figure out, you know, how to go through and fix a bunch of errors that might be created if I try and do a restore of a backup or a clone of my other site and try and migrate that over to this new domain. I'm trying to figure out a way where I don't have to really worry about that all that much, but I'm still going to do some more research. It's going to be an ongoing project, and I will update you in this podcast on my progress. That's what I figure. So I'm going to do that with another site too. I think I might have mentioned it yesterday that we're starting the Golden Hour Experience podcast. And we've also started the goldenhourexperience.com website. And so I'm going to try and go through the same process over on that site so that I can import a bunch of the settings that I have from goldenhourwedding.com and try and put it together in a way so that I get to save a bunch of time and not have to redevelop a WordPress site from scratch again. So that's the hope of it. And it could work. It seems like if I pay just a little bit of money, I can make it work, which might make it worth it, I figure. The other news that I was going to get to was some stuff about ebooks. I'm sure you're excited now. Thanks for listening to all this.
Thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. A few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts. All pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.